This week, I have been doing a considerable amount of thought and reflection unrelated to the sermon, so hopefully that will not be evident. But what I've been reflecting about, I imagine most, if not nearly all of you, are aware of, that Fred Phelps died this week. He died Thursday evening, I believe, or Wednesday evening. And if you don't recall who that is by the name, you may recall the signs that he would use to protest at the funerals of people who died of HIV and AIDS, and most recently, the funerals of veterans because of the removal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban against gay, lesbian, bi, and trans folks openly serving. And for decades, his protests were a scourge on many people's lives. So what I've been reflecting about is the nature of God. It is a danger of the profession, I suppose. And the nature of the hereafter, except for a rare few who actually have a glimpse of life in the hereafter. Even the most devout and religious must admit that the details of what we anticipate after death constitute a great deal of speculation. We may get glimpses, but most is still speculation. So I've been wondering about that intersection of the kind of God that Fred Phelps preached and the kind of God that might be met in death. And then, what kind of God do I, in fact, worship? Is the God that we preach in our lives the God we actually want to meet in our death? There's a quote from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 7 that says, "With the judgment you make, you will be judged. With the measure you give will be the measure you get." So it has led me to wonder, do I want God's judgment of hellfire and brimstone upon other people and not expect to be held accountable for the ways, big or small, that I have hurt others? Or do I expect that God is going to embrace me with love and grace and forgiveness and not expect that God's love and grace and forgiveness will extend to those whom I may even have called my enemies? What kind of God do we worship? And what kind of God do we proclaim in our lives with our words and with our actions? May it be the kind of God that we hope to meet in our deaths. Please pray with me. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be a delight in your sight, God, you who are our rock, our strength, and our Redeemer. Amen. So from those thoughts, we turn to one of my favorite stories in any of the Gospels. This meeting between Jesus and the unnamed Samaritan woman at the well. It is a conversation that might strike us as interesting, but it was more than just interesting to those who would have first heard it or those who witnessed it. It was scandalous. It was a scandal. The scene was Jesus and his disciples traveling through the rather hostile territory of Samaria. There were centuries of aversion and enmity between Jews and Samaritans. And that's the setup for this meeting between a, quote, chosen and the so-called unchosen rejected. And it's a public conversation between a man and an unknown, unrelated woman. So it breaks the cultural taboos around gender, and it would have called into question the motives of both the man and the woman in that conversation. So this is not just a casual exchange between strangers or a conversation at the water cooler, so to speak. This is charged with tensions. By addressing this Samaritan woman, Jesus steps on a cultural landmine. It's a scandalous conversation with an unnamed woman of an enemy people that turns out to be the longest conversation recorded by Jesus in any of the Gospels. This unnamed woman of an enemy people is the longest conversation that Jesus has with anyone in the Gospels. So, to quickly consider the scene we hear today with the meeting with Nicodemus that we heard about last week, if you were here and if you recall, that was last week's reading. Both of them are only in the Gospel of John, but they are so contrasting. Nicodemus was a named leader of the chosen people. He was an insider. This woman is an unnamed and hated Samaritan. She is an outsider. Nicodemus comes to Jesus in the hidden dark of night. Jesus speaks with this woman at the brightest time of day, at noon. Nicodemus initiates their meeting with gracious words. "We know you are a teacher." Jesus starts the conversation with the Samaritan woman with a very pragmatic request, a drink of water. And she starts out with, well, is it surprise? Is it suspicion? Is it with hostility? Nicodemus misunderstands at every turn what Jesus is saying. The Samaritan woman not only gets it, she gets excited about it. Nicodemus fades back into shadow. This Samaritan woman hurries back to town. And several verses later, when the story ends, we hear that many in Samaria come to believe and follow Jesus because of her telling everyone she knows. We never know if Nicodemus ultimately comes out as a follower of Jesus, but we do know she becomes the first recognizable evangelist of the good news of Jesus Christ. She may go unnamed, but she is unforgettable. It's a fascinating conversation. Jesus starts with very direct comments. "Give me a drink." It sounds simple, but it's not so simple because it's an opening for this image of living water, which she does not initially understand. Then he asks her to go and get your husband, which opens up a whole new window for her to be transparent, for him to show his insight. And I do want to say it's important to interject that when Jesus observes that she has had five husbands and the man she is with is not her husband, Jesus commends her for her honesty, but says nothing further. Any moralistic judgment upon her or her sexual history has to be imported from somewhere else because it is not on the lips of Jesus in this story. Jesus uses her life not as a reason to judge her, but as the beginning of a conversation. And it's at this moment when Jesus shows this penetrating knowledge of her personal life that she becomes alert that this is a unique opportunity. I'm in the presence of a real prophet, and I have some questions. This may be the holiest moment in the conversation, because no one hearing or reading this story in the ancient world could avoid what happened in that moment. She was no longer an objectified water carrier. She was no longer defined by men who did or did not possess her. She was no longer a despised other. She has her own intellect, her own soul, her own questions that she brings, and it is she who pushes this into a theological conversation. You know, there are lots of places with his own disciples, with religious authorities especially, that Jesus seemed rather annoyed by people's theological questions. But not with her. Not in this case. I think this actually might have been one of Jesus' favorite conversations too. So Jesus answers her questions about worship. It's not about fixing the correct where, but it's about the who and the how. Worshiping in spirit and truth, a memorable phrase. And then, knowing a little bit of theology herself, a little bit of teaching herself, she says, yes, 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 this will happen when the Messiah comes. And then, this revelation, Jesus says, I am that one. Now, scholars endlessly debate, did the historical Jesus ever self-identify as the Messiah? There are places in other Gospels where Jesus goes to great pains to conceal or tell others not to tell, or evades the question when he's asked. But here, in John's Gospel, there's the unequivocal statement that he is the awaited Messiah. And more than that, lest we miss it, the I am statement, which happens over and again in John, is an echo of that unspeakable name revealed to Moses at the burning bush. I am who I am. Jesus, not only Messiah, but Jesus daring to say, I am. Of all the moments, that's when the disciples come crashing in. Right then, right there, the disciples interrupt it all. They are shocked to see their teacher in this conversation for all kinds of reasons, and the woman then leaves, leaving her water jar, her bucket, behind at the well. So, you know, details in the gospel stories are quite important, details that we often skip over. And so often I think this detail of the Samaritan woman's abandoned bucket is more than just a quaint detail that is added for realism in the story, something that she may have forgotten in her haste or in her enthusiasm. I believe by intentionally telling us she left her bucket behind, her water jar, I'm calling it a bucket, I believe that the author is reminding us of the whole point of the story. This is a story about water. Not surprising, set in the desert. It's a story about water. It's interesting to note the companion story from the Hebrew Bible for this Sunday in the lectionary, that schedule of readings. The companion story is the story where Moses strikes the rock in the wilderness to provide water for the children of Israel as they're wandering thirsty. And you'll notice this gospel story begins by explicitly noting that this is set at Jacob's ancient well. It's a reminder that water, hidden in a rock or hidden deep in the well, water is the promise of life. No water, no life. You know, my elementary school experiment of sprouting seeds is going smashingly well. I don't know if you can see from there, but we've got quite a root on this pea, as well as a sprout of leaves. The squash has a nice green sprout going down. And even the nasturtium seeds have begun to sprout as well. But I'll tell you, that was not going to happen if there wasn't water in here. Neither would the mold have been happening. But We'll just avoid that little detail of my experiment. But the sprouts are going smashingly well, and it wouldn't have happened without water, because it's the water that stirred the promise of life hidden in the seeds. It stirred them to life. This is a story about water, but it makes the point that it's a story not just about any water. It's a story about living water. Living water has really two meanings. Living water, the water that gives life, is certainly the dominant understanding of what Jesus is saying. We get that. Water is life. Living water is also the name, however, for water that moves and flows, like a fountain that bubbles, a running stream, a surging river is living water. Living water is what was actually called for in the earliest descriptions of baptism. John baptized in the Jordan, living water. Sort of just as Jesus described to Nicodemus the wind that comes and goes where it will, the Spirit is living water. It moves, and it's unable to really be contained or contained forever or for long. So I believe the detail that this woman left her water, her bucket, behind at the well is because once she had this face-to-face conversation with the divine, once she tasted living water, she knew if she tried to catch it in a bucket, it would stop moving and it would stop living. We all have buckets, don't we? Our buckets may be ways of thinking, ways of doing things. They may be traditions, practices, habits. They may be our favorite choruses or the creeds that we recite. They could be backgrounds, buildings, beliefs, containers that admittedly do their very best to carry water. They have an important role because they help get something we need from one place to another. But do they carry living water? Buckets are useful for a time, but they always reach their limits. And water in a bucket doesn't especially move, does it? I mean, it sloshes around a little bit for a while. A leaky bucket might drip. But the water doesn't flow anywhere. Water in a bucket isn't alive any longer. Makes me wonder if the church is a bucket, or if the church might best be the banks of a river from whence we draw living water rather than trying to still it and contain it. Like that ancient woman, we are all bringing our buckets because we're thirsty for a drink. So I want to ask, will you leave your bucket behind? Or are we going to try and capture and contain and keep it for ourselves, for those who are like me and mine? Are we going to turn living water to something dead and still? Samaritan woman left her bucket behind because she got it. Only living vessels. She, you, me. Living vessels of any size whatsoever. Only living vessels. That's right. That's an amen, Corey. That's an amen. Okay, all right. Just in case, all right. Living vessels carry living water. And when you carry living water, just as Jesus promised within her, within us, that spring of water gushes up from within. You are a portable fountain. Who needs a bucket anymore? Like her, we carry our buckets, our spirits thirsty for a drink at the well, will we, like her, take a drink of living water? Like her, then leave our bucket behind.